I am delighted to be here, and I want first off to express my appreciation to the Mac for Africa group for inviting me, and to Citi and to Brendan Stone for making me welcome and paving all the little bumps in the road for me to be here this afternoon. I'm finding it a little warm in here, so I'm going to take off my jacket. That's okay. I wasn't sure what kind of an audience we're going to have, but you look like a pretty good audience, so I'm delighted. I should say, first of all, the talk isn't going to last an hour, so you can relax. It'll be somewhat less than an hour, but I thought I'd wait to see what the audience looked like before I decided exactly how to handle this. And I think, oops, I'm on the top of a live keyboard. I think what I will do is I will read a little bit from my book to kind of put us in location. And then I have a bit of a speech or a talk that is kind of develops the thesis that I tried to make in the book, and that I think, you know, a group like this might be interested in exploring. And then when we're finished with that, we should have ample time for some discussion, some question and answer, or back and forth, or whatever. We'll fill up the hour in that way, if that's all right. Come on in.
Just start.
To give me another little bit of a sense too about the audience, how many of you, or anybody here, was born in any country on the continent of Africa? Bonnie? No one else? Okay. And how many have set foot in any country in the continent of Africa? So, quite a few, about half. Great. How many, is there anybody here, is a journalist or a filmmaker? Oh, good. Well, no, I only say that because my connections that led to this book are actually involved in through my work as a journalist and a filmmaker. And the part that I was going to read from the book actually is a section that's essentially a memoir section, which is all kind of backstory to doing that kind of work on the road. I mean, I've made lots of films in Canada and elsewhere too, but the section I was going to read was about the project of trying to find some characters to be in a documentary film that I made for the National Film Board in Kenya about 10 years ago. Okay, and it'll be kind of self-explanatory as I read it, so I won't go into a lot of explanation. But the whole context for the bit that I'm reading is more memoir rather than, you know, analysis so I'll just leave it at that and read a section called "Looking for a Prostitute." On a bright morning in December 1996, I made my way along a breeze-filled corridor in the University of Nairobi Medical School. a rabbit's warren of offices, many of them in need of a good paint job, opening off open-air hallways and staircases. I was looking for Dr. Elizabeth Ngugi, who had promised to put me in touch with a prostitute. Many prostitutes, actually. I had come to Nairobi to scout locations and interviews for a film, this time about the research that Canadian and, to a lesser degree, American and British scientists were doing in a shantytown with a group of sex workers who, despite the fact that they had sex several times a day with truck drivers, never became infected with HIV. This extraordinary discovery both puzzled and enthralled the scientific world and provoked people like me to want to find out more about the story. Dr. Ngugi, the Director of Community Health for Kenya, had been the main contact between the women and the scientists for almost 10 years. She was going to be my connection, too. I found her at her desk, barely visible behind a chaotic stack of files and papers. To say I was apprehensive would have been an understatement. Dr. Ngugi was highly respected, but I had been warned that she could be acerbic, or even unpredictable, and nobody wanted to get on her wrong side. A small woman with sharp edges, she stood up and removed her glasses. An automobile accident had put out one of her eyes and disfigured her face, but the fearsome thing was something below the surface. She had the personality of a coiled spring. Yes, she said, she had already arranged for me to meet the chairperson of the prostitutes committee. I would find this person in one of the slums, a place called Matari. The good doctor herself was far too busy to accompany me, but her assistant, a friendly-looking woman named Lynette, who had just breezed into the room, would go with me. While she had us in her office, though, Dr. Ngugi was going to provide a lecture. She moved around to the side of her desk. When people say prostitute, she said with the ring of a warning, they only see a woman, not the man. The prostitute, however, is not simply the person who sells sex, but also the person who buys the sex. Her point was that if there was any stigma, it should be spread around. She was a champion of the women and determined to protect them from having to carry all the burdens by themselves. Here, of course, they weren't prostitutes anyway. They had been given the far more dignified title of commercial sex workers. And the very fact that they were organized and had a chairperson was in no small measure due to Dr. Ngugi's influence. Eventually, Lynette and I were let go and soon were making our way through the city in the doctor's chugging yellow Isuzu van. Nairobi was built as a junction on the railway from the Indian Ocean coast of Mombasa to Kampala in Uganda. What ultimately became the Kenyan capital city is at about the halfway point, a good day's trip from both other cities. It is on high ground, almost 2 kilometers above sea level, which gives it a moderated climate and no malarial mosquitoes. Driving through Nairobi made me happy. By that time, I'd already been twice to Kenya, as well as Zimbabwe, Angola, and a tiny corner of Zambia. In the same manner it has with other travelers, Africa was getting hold of me. There were moments back home on some wintry days when I would close my eyes and daydream a landscape of acacia trees or conjure the recollection of a precise moment of being seated at a breakfast table with a certain whiff of breeze entering through the open window. It didn't matter that these trips I made usually involved looking at people's troubles. An attraction that was entirely sentimental and romantic had taken hold. Riding in the subway or walking on the street in Toronto, or when I'd be in some other city like London, I might overhear a fragment of conversation in just the right accent, which would be enough to send me into roils of happy sadness, itching to find the means to buy another ticket. I could now only embrace as good fortune the fact that I had a chance to stay in Kenya for a couple of months and have it paid for by the National Film Board of Canada. You folks. Like all African cities, Nairobi has become horrifically overcrowded. The pleasant colonial suburbs increasingly overwhelmed by burgeoning shantytowns, one of which we were heading toward this morning. When we got there, we certainly knew it. Entering the slum was like hitting a wall. Immediately, a press of people, carts, and bicycles reduced our progress to a snail's pace. Lynette, grasping the steering wheel with tense knuckles, pushed resolutely ahead, while I couldn't help but notice that whenever we reached a particularly tight spot where I might think there was no more possibility, magically, in front of us, like the Red Sea, the crowd would part. Lynette looked over at me. "Everybody recognizes Dr. Ngugi's car," she said. Eventually, however, even that wasn't enough, and we truly could drive no further. We abandoned the car and set off on foot under the broiler of the late morning sun. We entered immediately into a maze of pathways, narrow and well-beaten, snaking amongst mud-sided huts. The huts were completely makeshift, but at the same time quite tidy, in the way I realized you have to be when your existence is precarious in the face of rain and wind and sun. Some had tin roofs, others were covered by sheets of plywood. A few were put together from nothing more than the cardboard from packing crates. Everywhere was the mania of life. Women scrubbing laundry in open tubs, men braising ears of maize in smoky little charcoal fires, children, dogs, cats, chickens, even a lonesome, scrawny goat. Incessant noise assaulted the ears, and an overpowering smell hit the nose. The kind of infusing stench that sticks inside your nostrils, your hair, and your clothes so that you worry you might never get rid of it. This was produced in the main by steaming mounds of uncollected garbage. Regularly, we had to take giant steps across gutters that ran with stinky water. We turned a corner at the mud plaster hut of the chairperson for the Sex Workers Committee. Lynette rapped briskly on the door and then, not waiting for an answer, pushed through. "Hello," she rang out. The hut was a tiny two-room affair, and in the second room, where I could see the corner of a big bed beyond a half-open curtain, the chairperson of the Prostitutes Committee was just completing some business. A startled-looking middle-aged man scrambled to do up his trousers. I was embarrassed, though nobody else seemed to be. "I see you've got company," Lynette said cheerily. The chair of the Sex Workers Committee was a large woman with a round pumpkin of a face topped by a pad of fluffy hair. She sat upright, a robe half covering her silk slip. Then, when Lynette disappeared behind the curtain for a conference, the client, a man with a broad, guileless face, didn't hurry away as one might have expected, but took a seat in the kitchen where he and I eyeballed one another awkwardly. I couldn't help thinking how unlike a brothel this place was, not to mention that the absolute last thing I'd have wanted to consider was having sex. But then it wasn't my taste in eroticism that was going to prevail. The tradition of prostitution in these shanty towns, I'd been told, went back some 80 years to the days of the railroad construction and was more akin, in fact, to a landlady and her tenants. In the early days, prostitutes were the true landlords, the only people to own their own huts. The customers were transient workers away from home needing and wanting more than anything, their laundry done, meals, a bed in which to sleep. The provision of sex came merely as part of a full-service boarding house. Now, however, it appeared it was just sex. Eventually, the fellow across from me seemed happy enough to talk. He told me his name was Benson, and when I asked what he did for a living, he answered proudly, "I am a church worker." Then, as sort of an afterthought, "An Anglican." He was not, it turned out, a proper cleric, but a sort of verger in charge of looking after a church building downtown. The walls of the room were painted a well-scuffed blue. A couple of tattered AIDS posters served as decoration. The only thing shiny and new was an economy-sized jar of Vaseline. The lion's share of space was taken up by a gigantic box almost as big as a refrigerator, prominently labeled USAID. 100 gross of condoms meant to be distributed around the neighborhood to the various other women. Through the flapping shutter of the window, I could see children hopping back and forth across puddles of sewage. The chair of the Prostitutes Committee emerged from the other room, dressed now in a sleeveless shift, and was introduced to me by Lynette. "Missouri," I said. I learned a few Swahili terms and figured this would be the time to use them. The woman looked a bit bemused. She was quite large, and with Lynette, me, and Benson, the room was pretty much filled. Still, the outside door pushed open and two more people squeezed in, a small child and a woman, another sex worker. "Missouri," I said again. This time everybody started to snicker. Lynette looked at me. "Forgive us," she said, "but we have to correct you." Confused, I wondered what I'd done. Lynette went on patiently. "In Swahili, there are two parts to the greeting, Habari and Missouri," she said, "which are the equivalent in English of the question, how are you? And then the answer, I am fine." I realized instantly what I'd been doing. "You are turning it around," she continued. "Without waiting to be asked, you're greeting people by saying, I am fine, I am fine." Everybody had a good laugh at the visiting white man's expense. And Benson, finally enjoying some male camaraderie in a room crowded with women, chucked me on the shoulder. Abruptly, however, the mood then shifted. "Tell Larry about your work," Lynette instructed. "He wants to know about commercial sex workers." The two sex worker women looked at one another, and then, in the complaining manner in which a factory laborer might deplore everything from the boss to paltry wages, launched into a kind of lengthy discursion. Here, wages or prices were decidedly paltry, 50 to 200 Kenyan shillings per encounter, about $1 to $5. And the work was undisputably tedious and repetitive. The women meandered around these laments for a bit before getting to the core of the matter, both for them and for me, AIDS, and the issue of their sisters becoming ill with it, dying, and leaving their children as orphans with no one but the other prostitutes to look after them. This was a great burden. "What are you going to do?" the newly arrived sex worker asked, moving with urgency right into my face. "What is the West going to do?" Another half hour passed, at which point Lynette got up and commenced slapping hands in farewell. She and I were going to leave. Benson waited behind, a hopeful look pasted on his broad face. Out in the street, the main traffic remained children who swarmed us. "Hey, Mzungu," they chirped in their little voices, meaning white man. "How are you?" The only English phrase they knew.